You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm Samantha Gross. I'm fellow and director in the Brookings Institution's Energy Security and Climate Initiative. And I'm really happy to welcome all of you to our panel this afternoon talking about how the U.S. election will impact U.S. engagement on climate change. Right now, we're less than 3 weeks away from one of the most consequential elections, certainly in my life, probably in your life too, and particularly because of the diametrically opposed views of the two candidates on climate change. There's so much to talk about, and I'm really grateful today to have a very varied and interesting panel today with a wide variety of experiences and expertise. I have two journalists, I have a young activist, and I have three of our own from here at Brookings. So I'd like to introduce all the panelists, and then I'll go straight into Q&A. I'm sure no one came on to hear me talk. So first we have Sara Mehr, who is an activist and the founder of Plus One Vote. Lisa Friedman, she's a reporter at the New York Times. Nate Holtman, one of our Brookings people, he's a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings, an associate professor and director at the Center for Global Sustainability at the University of Maryland. Adele Morris, another of my colleagues at Brookings, she's senior fellow and policy director for the Climate, Energy, and Economics Project. Barry Rabe, our third Brookings person. He's a non-resident senior fellow and a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. And finally, we have Sammy Roth, who's a staff writer at the LA Times, who covers energy and climate issues. So I'd like to say thanks to all of you for joining us today. I'm just thrilled at the level of experience and the kinds of points of view that we have with us. But I want to get right into the issues because we've got a lot to talk about. So Lisa, I'd like to start with you. President Trump came into office promising a deregulatory agenda and with great skepticism of climate change. What, in your opinion, and you and your colleagues at the Times have covered this extensively over the Trump administration, what do you think are his most impactful actions to fulfill those deregulatory promises and to reflect his skepticism about climate?
Thanks, Samantha. And first of all, thank you so much for having me at Brookings. It's an honor to be on the panel with everyone here. As you laid out in your sort of opening remarks, the two, you know, Biden and Trump could not be more different on this issue. And President Trump came in, as you said, you know, very clear about his position. He called climate change a hoax. He's said other words about climate change since, but his actions, you know, and he has pledged to make deregulation and the development of fossil fuels a major part of his agenda, and he has delivered on it. I was going through before this panel a list we have of the 100 or so regulations that he has rolled back on the environment, and you ask what's the most important. It's hard to choose, but I would say that if there is no regulation to address climate change, either mitigation or adaptation, that he has not worked to roll back. And so the most significant ones, I'd say, are the Clean Power Plan, which was President Obama's regulatory action to set national standards and reduce emissions from the power sector, vehicle emissions reductions, and addressing leaks from the oil and gas sector, methane. Those have all been repealed and replaced, and they will be battled in the courts. But those, I think, are some of the most significant climate regulations that are now gone from the books.
Sammy, from your point of view out on the West Coast, how do you view Trump's most impactful actions?
Well, I think something that Lisa mentioned that's especially important in California is this issue on vehicle emissions. In addition to rolling back, you know, the federal vehicle efficiency standard, the Trump administration has tried to revoke this authority that California has had for decades now to set its own fuel efficiency standards that are stronger than the federal government's. And that's particularly impactful from a climate standpoint because another dozen states have sort of signed on to California's standard. So that's still working its way through the courts, and I think is you know really one of the big one that's hit California. The other thing I would mention from a California and Western perspective is public lands issues in particular. And, you know, the bulk of, you know, America's federally managed public lands are in the West. There's, you know, really strong bipartisan support, you know, across the Western states, not just the more liberal ones, for policies to protect public lands. And, you know, what you've seen from the Trump administration and from the Bureau of Land Management is this really aggressive effort to, you know, sell as many oil and gas leases as possible, which is something that Joe Biden has explicitly said he would stop doing, and federal oil and gas leasing. So I think those are two areas that you know, have sort of especially resonated here.
Yeah, the vehicle efficiency standards is such an important one. That California waiver has been in place since the beginning of the Clear Air Act in the Nixon administration. It's not a new thing. Saad, I'd like to turn to you. You've gone from studying environmental policy to moving on to found an organization that's focused on encouraging young Americans to vote. How has the Trump presidency affected young Americans who care about climate change? Are they discouraged, emboldened, maybe a little of each?
I think that young people are looking at the system as it is, and we are seeing every single crack that there is in what we're told these institutions are supposed to be, right? And in many ways, I think we often try to talk about it as if these are some sort of bugs in the system, but these are features. Our system is designed to give power to certain types of people and to embolden them to continue along that certain pathway. And what that's doing for the climate crisis is really exacerbating what we're seeing across the country. And really, you know, as young people looking at this, we're kind of like, what's going on here? Are we supposed to be able to have a president who's able to lie and just tweet disinformation every couple of hours and throw the world into chaos? Are we supposed to be able to be thrown into a massive, massive pandemic? Are we supposed to have economic recessions every couple of years, just like as a casual thing? That's all I've ever known in my lifetime. And so we're seeing these giant cracks in our system. And for young people, we're sort of looking at this and saying, with this election, hey, either we're going toward giving permission to an authoritarian regime, or we're going toward a pathway that's at least something we're familiar with and can work with, can lobby for more progressive policies on climate action, and can change that dynamic. I think there's an understanding of really what is at stake in this election regarding the future of climate policy.
Yeah, it sounds like you're describing a really galvanized youth. Excellent. That's good to hear. Barry, I'd like to turn to you on some of the more technical aspects of what's going on in the Trump administration right now. You have a new book out that I'm happy to plug a little for you called Trump, the Administrative Presidency and Federalism, in which you explore how the Trump administration has used executive orders and regulatory changes to roll back many of the policies of the Obama administration. How might this play out in a second Trump term? Has he deregulated all he can deregulate? What might be some actions that Trump might take if he finds himself reelected? Barry, I think you might be on mute if you're speaking.
Apologies.
No worries.
I think this has been an ongoing challenge in policy because it's now been 30 years since the last reauthorization of the Clean Air Act, 33 years since Clean Water. We've had presidents try to maximize their impact, and Donald Trump has taken that to new extremes. Clearly, in a second term, though, there would be an opportunity to consolidate and finalize some of the rules and interpretations that Lisa mentioned that are still pending, emerging in the courts, possibly moving forward in a court system that would be much, much more receptive to some of these deregulatory steps and sort of shrinking the role. But I also think that what we have seen increasingly, especially in agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, is a marginalization on the technical expertise of staff. These are agencies that have a lot of expertise and historically have played a large role in rulemaking, interpreting science. We know a lot of those folks have taken retirement and left. And in a second term, you could really begin to see evisceration of our ability to use and apply science in constructive ways in climate and most areas of the environment.
That's a frightening future to think about. Nate, I want to turn to you. You have been particularly involved in the America's Pledge effort, which has come forward as a way of putting forward American action despite the fact that the Trump administration has pulled away from the Paris Agreement. And I'm curious to hear, what could government do if Trump is reelected? Do we absolutely need a different president to make progress? Or are there things that we can continue to do at the state and local level should Trump be reelected with respect to the climate?
So thanks, Samantha. And the short answer is yes to both of those questions. We do need ultimately to have an all-in strategy that includes the executive and legislative branches at the national level. But at the same time, progress can be made in other ways. So let's make no mistake, as the past speakers have noted, the past 4 years have seen a major erosion of leadership internationally and at the national level from the executive. And as somebody who was involved in some of the previous domestic regulatory agenda that Barry's been writing about and our international strategy as part of the Obama White House, I can say that the loss of these policies has been a significant setback. On the other hand, it's critically important to see the full picture of climate action across our economy and our whole federal system. It's just one example. Coal retirements have actually accelerated in the past 4 years as the ground has been shifting rapidly owing to subnational actions, precipitous clean energy, cost decreases, and shifting public opinion. The coalitions and subnational actors that you mentioned now represent 65% of U.S. population and nearly 70% of U.S. GDP. If they were a country, they would constitute the world's second largest economy. Those actors have been undertaking a wide variety of policies that drive forward emissions reductions in their own jurisdictions, and work that you've mentioned that I've been involved in over the past 4 years with the America's Pledge Initiative and other coalitions like We Are Still In, US Climate Alliance, and others have demonstrated the surprising impact that these actors have had in delivering on the overall US emissions trajectory. So to your question, under a Trump reelection, we would likely see an acceleration of this kind of subnational action. And depending on the election outcomes across the country, particularly down ballot, a number of additional new leaders could be expanding on these actions as well. Exactly how those would manifest and the degree of coordination that they would pursue remain critical and super interesting questions that these leaders would have to tackle immediately after the election.
Thanks so much, Nate. Adele, I'd like to follow up with you on another really important 2016 Trump priority, and that was his focus on coal-reliant communities and on bringing back coal, talking about beautiful clean coal, in fact. However, that hasn't really played out as his administration has gone on. Can you talk a little bit about the status of how coal-reliant communities are doing? Was bringing back coal ever realistic? And what could an administration potentially do to help some of the people in these communities? I'd like to bring in a little bit of an environmental justice component. It's not their fault that those communities are reliant on a fuel that is going out of style, let's say.
Yeah, thanks, Samantha. And you know, just real quickly back to what Lisa was talking about, on our Brookings.edu website, we have a deregulation tracker. It's tracking deregulation in the Trump era. And if you want to go in there and see what's been happening, both in the environmental regulatory sphere, but in other regulatory areas as well, you can check that out. So President Trump, as a candidate in 2016, made a lot of promises to the people of coal country. He says, you know, get ready. We're going to put you back to work. Now, the problem was, you know, he was pointing to the challenges to coal as a result of the Clean Power Plan that Lisa mentioned and other regulatory actions. Well, that was a fiction. We know from very careful econometric analysis that 90 plus percent of the decline in coal production and consumption in the United States was driven by persistently low natural gas prices. And those are very close substitutes in the primary market for coal, which is the power sector. So coal was eroding in terms of market share for the power sector for years before that. And now in this recession, the demand for electricity has shrunk even further. And we're just, you know, the coal plants that still exist are not running as much and they become even less economic. So we're seeing an acceleration of the, you know, the decline in coal consumption. And that's without climate policy of any kind. Maybe the long run anticipation of policy someday, and that goes into your long life capital decisions. But we're not seeing a decline in coal as a result of policy right now. Maybe to a minor degree, state and local policies, but it's mostly economics. And, you know, you can't repeal supply and demand just because you're president. So I think what we're looking at going forward, if we do address our climate goals and impose some kind of constraint on greenhouse gas emissions, that's going to amplify the reduction in coal use in the United States very sharply, very rapidly. So my work, there's a paper we had out last year called The Risk of Fiscal Collapse in Coal-Reliant Communities, looks at the risks associated with relying on coal, both in the current economic conditions, but also going forward in a carbon-constrained world. You know, these communities really need to prepare for what's going to be an intense transition. And I think policymakers who are adopting climate policy can work those considerations into the legislation, help protect the health and pension benefits of the workers, help make sure those mines are reclaimed to a reasonable ecological standard, make sure that folks have opportunities to retrain for other industries or retire early if that's not feasible. So I think there are a number of good policy ideas that can be folded in to climate policy that would help any disproportionate burdens and people who are already suffering.
Thanks. Before I shift gears into talking about the policies of Vice President Biden, I forgot to say something at the beginning, and that's for those of you in the audience, if you'd like to ask a question to put it in the queue, there's two ways you can do that. One is you can email events@brookings.edu, or you can tweet to the hashtag policy2020, and we'll get those emails agglomerated and we'll ask as many of those questions as we can. But let's turn now to talking about the policies of a potential President Biden. It's been an interesting time. Clearly, he comes from a very different place than President Trump. However, there's been some squabbling on the left about how far to go with climate around things like the Green New Deal. And so let's talk a bit about where Vice President Biden has found himself with respect to climate. And Lisa, again, I'd like to go to you because you've been involved with so much coverage here. How has Biden's climate policies evolved as he's moved from being a primary candidate to being the Democratic nominee?
Well, I mean, I'll just preface this by saying, if the Biden people were on this, they would say his views have not evolved at all. He's always been. but it is clear that, you know, I mean, every other person that you talk to who has been a champion on climate change, including others who, you know, who ran on a climate platform, have said that Mr. Biden has evolved. You know, the specific ways, I mean, I'll get to some of the ways that he has, you know, his actual plan has gotten much bigger, a bigger price tag, much more ambitious, a much more ambitious timeline. You know, he's planning to spend $2 trillion over 4 years. He's aiming to eliminate emissions from the power sector by 2035. Really big deal. Reach net zero emissions, you know, before 2050. But I'm glad that Adele spoke so much about natural gas, because that is really the heart of where tensions still remain on the left around President Biden and his commitment to addressing climate change. We hear very often President Trump accusing Vice President Biden of wanting to ban fracking. He has been very clear that he does not intend to ban fracking. He intends to eliminate new permits for fracking on federal lands and waters. But that is something that, you know, that progressives really do want to see. And while for many years, the fight over fracking was primarily around dangers to water quality, you know, these days, the effort to end fracking is explicitly tied to an effort to phase out and eventually eliminate natural gas. You know, there is debate in this space, but a number of energy experts say if we want to reach this goal of eliminating net zero, of reaching net zero emissions before 2050, we can't be building new fossil fuel development of any type. And so, you know, we have Vice President Biden who has been using phrases that, you know, we've heard over and over during the Obama years that natural gas is an important bridge fuel. There are folks on the left who say it, you know, we've passed the bridge. and that is a fight that we're going to see play out if there is a Biden administration over what role natural gas will continue to play and whether he will push to really eliminate fossil fuels or work more on the effort to boost renewables.
Yeah, and I'll just add the moderator's note that banning fracking in the United States really would bring oil and gas production, not to a complete screeching halt, but close. So much of the growth and the production that we see happening in the U.S. today is reliant on the hydraulic fracturing technology. Sammy, turning to you, have these changes in Biden policy, the fact that his they might say it hasn't, but his policy has gotten more ambitious, but he also is still in line with some continuing fossil fuel production. Is this satisfying to West Coast voters, and is it meeting the specific needs of that part of the world?
Well, I mean, a little hard for me to speak on behalf of West Coast voters. I don't know that I've seen really good polling that's, you know, specific to the California and the West on the, you know, specifics of Biden's plan. You know, I haven't heard too much consternation about it. I think in general, like in a lot of the rest of the country, you've had, you know, the Sunrise Movement come around to Biden. And I think you're seeing something similar in California. I mean, but a couple things that stand out in his plan from a Western perspective. I mean, Lisa mentioned the, you know, really ambitious goal of a fully decarbonized electricity sector by 2035. What's really striking about that, that's 10 years ahead of California's current target, which is 2045 decarbonized electric sector. And when, you know, when the California legislature passed that 2 years ago, it was, I think it was technically the second state to adopt a 100% clean energy policy after Hawaii, as I recall, but it was a really big deal. And it set off this wave of states over the next year doing that. And it was seen as, wow, you know, 100% clean energy in law, that's crazy. And now, you know, Joe Biden is saying do it 10 years sooner. So, I mean, I think that just reflects how quickly, you know, this debate and this conversation is evolving. I think on natural gas, a lot of those same debates that are, you know, playing out nationally over Biden and fracking are being seen in California, but sort of in a more advanced stage. I mean, in the power sector, California has already pretty much gotten rid of coal. You know, natural gas is our largest electricity source now. And so now the place that conversation is, you know, how quickly can we shut down these gas plants as well and replace them with something cleaner? And that's, you know, that's creating a lot of debate. California had rolling blackouts 2 months ago. They were brief. It's not, you know, exactly the case that it was, you know, caused by renewable energy or climate policy, but certainly, you know, gas plants having shut down, you know, if there'd been more gas plants online, it probably would have been easier to keep the lights on then. So that's a debate that's very real here. It's happening with gas use in buildings. There's debate over, you know, gas stoves and gas heating. It's become very real here very quickly in a way that I think is going to become even more so for the rest of the country.
I think in all this debate over whether or not he's in line with the Green New Deal or whether he's ambitious enough, that 2035 clean electricity rule, the pure ambition behind that sometimes gets lost in the discussion. I'm really glad you brought that up. Saad, you're our representative of the younger voter here. Sorry to put all of that on you, but Joe Biden wasn't the first choice for many younger voters. He's 77 years old. He occasionally throws out some expressions that are sound pretty antiquated to the younger ear. But are young voters coming together behind Biden? Have they decided that he may not be perfect, but we don't want that to be the enemy of the good? Is his centrism a turnoff, or are young voters coming around?
You know, Samantha, I still don't know what malarkey is exactly. I don't think any of us young people still understand what exactly was the effort there. But I think that I was actually talking to Senator Ed Markey a few weeks ago, and that was another race where we saw, you know, age being a really big factor in how people were framing these discussions, right? Obviously, Senator Ed Markey was running against Congressman Joe Kennedy, who was basically half his age. And no shade to Senator Ed Markey. But, I think looking at that, it's not about the age of the candidate. It's about the age of the ideas, right? And what we've seen with Biden is him coming forward on his opinion of a lot of these climate policies, right? And while I think a lot of younger people would like someone who is more progressive and more ambitious, I think even framing it like the way we often frame these conversations is around like a price tag. Like, what is the price tag of Joe Biden's climate policy? And it's $2 trillion, right? And we saw this really play out in the debates of $10 trillion and a couple billion and how we're looking at that. As if to say that on the other side, the price tag was zero, right? And that just simply isn't the case, right? We know the climate crisis will cost trillions and trillions of dollars. It's already costing so much money across the US. Even I'm doing this live stream right here from my home on Long Island. Hurricane Sandy devastated this area, and we're still paying off the billions of dollars that were a result of that storm. I lost electricity here, for days a couple weeks ago from another storm. My brother is sending me pictures of orange skies in California and can't leave his house because he can't breathe because of the air quality, right? And so we're seeing these costs of the climate crisis mount up, and people are still suggesting that the alternative to a $2 trillion climate policy is nothing. And so I think the way we're framing those discussions in general is wrong. And I think that, Joe Biden has come forward, has agreed to spend a lot more money on this crisis, has shown a willingness to be more forward in how progressive his policies are, has shown he can negotiate with AOC, the Sunrise Movement, all these other young activists out and about protesting. And so I think there's a lot more faith in that and in a $2 trillion plan. Call it the Green New Deal or not, it doesn't matter. The Green New Deal is just a framework. Nobody cares what title you give it. And so I think that it's really important that we understand the difference between what is being proposed on both of these sides, because $2 trillion and just a complete lack of understanding and silence on what any sort of policy is. I'm still waiting 4 years later of what exactly is the plan on climate from the other side.
Your point about the cost of doing nothing definitely not being zero is extremely well taken, and I can't resist. Definitely not a bunch of malarkey. That's brilliant. Barry, this kind of leads naturally to a question I had teed up for you, and that is, so we think about the things that President Biden would want to do, and certain of them are easy. They're the kinds of things like rejoining Paris. He can just do that. But a lot of other actions are going to be really hard. Where should he start? And, a $2 trillion plan, how does one even begin to think about implementing a $2 trillion plan? Where do you begin?
And Samantha, this is where it gets really hard. Expectations will be sky high for what a President Biden should do. Heal the nation. Deal with criminal justice. Turn around the economy. Deal with the pandemic. Protect public health, especially if the Affordable Care Act faces further challenges. And that's just the beginning. And also deal with the climate crisis. So the pressures will be extraordinary. And then as a president, as you note, rejoining Paris is easy. Thinking about that piece is pretty straightforward. But then where do you go? And there's no one obvious path. If one wants to revisit the executive or administrative route, that is there, but there are potholes in that path that have been left by the Trump administration, and particularly thinking about almost any administrative action that a President Biden might take, would almost immediately be challenged by 20 or more Republican attorneys general, just as we've seen in the last two presidencies. We would go into a court loaded with more than 200 new Trump appointees and possibly fundamental changes in how environmental law and administrative law cases are dealt with. So the administrative route, in my view, is loaded with challenges. Then there's the legislative route. And I think a big question really hangs over this, however this is designed. And clearly, Biden has done something we almost never see from a successful presidential nominee. And that is to reach out to the candidates he just defeated and try to expand that coalition and make adjustments in his policy. But with it, as that coalition expands, how do you ultimately go into a legislative framework and get anything done, given the track record that I was talking about earlier? And we've seen Democratic presidents and Democratic Congresses, first term Clinton, first term Obama, where it seemed like a slam dunk that climate or environmental legislation was going to pass, and it didn't. That path is also going to be really, really challenging, regardless of what exactly goes into that policy package.
Nate, this brings me to a question that I've wanted to ask you, and that is about U.S. credibility as we think about rejoining the Paris Agreement. I fear that a lot of the folks in the international community are going to sit back and say, yeah, I've seen this movie before. We know how this ends. How does a potential Biden presidency, how does he signal that we're serious about this? And how do we again become a useful player on the international stage? And we all understand that we can't go climate alone. We're all in this together.
Yeah, great question. And you're absolutely right. Just like I think Barry's comment about all the other pressing issues, this is yet another one where there's a kind of credibility gap and some new work that needs to be done. So my view on this is that credibility is rooted in domestic action. And that means that we have to get back to what we're doing at home and make sure that mindful of the challenges that Barry, I think, very eloquently laid out, deal with it. To me, that there's sort of four elements of what we need to do. It's first, you know, a broad plan that recognizes opportunities across all sectors and all gases, sort of making very clear that we are pursuing on multiple fronts that would likely include a rapid phase down of fossil generation, as we were talking about recently. Second, you build on the tremendous momentum from these laboratories of democracy, the states and cities and business action that we've talked about that frankly have driven forward climate action in a lot of ways, not every single way, but again, states have some tremendous opportunities in electricity sector policy and they've used them. And so means that we build on that, create a comprehensive policy that pulls all these actors in and creates a new regulatory approach. Potentially, as Barry said, with new legislation, mindful of the challenges, but that's a sort of second dimension. Looking beyond policies that simply focus on energy or sort of emissions particularly, but I would say not necessarily, but like the Green New Deal concept, something that is all of economy, that includes investment in sustainable infrastructure, that includes what we talked about before, which is some dimension of transitions or even just transitions, answering our broader moment that we're called at this time to think through. And then finally, then reinvigorating in parallel, it's not a sequence, right? This is all in parallel. As we're doing that, we also invigorate our international leadership. I mean, we have been and we can continue to be a leader in terms of bilateral engagements with a lot of other key countries, as well as an international leader in the space. We all know that that's been a role the U.S. has really taken on very vigorously for the most part for the last 70 plus years with some occasional hiatus. And we can recapture that and try to think through what we can do to support higher global ambition. And so in my view, that those things are fundamentally linked without doing any of the kind of groundwork that sort of is involved in building a domestic plan. International credibility will be low. And so we really do have to focus on linking them together.
Thanks so much. Adele, I want to turn to you, and this is actually keying back into something that Saad said, and that is the idea that the cost of doing nothing is not zero. You've done some significant work with financial regulators and with central banks assessing climate risk and how climate risk could play out in the financial system. Could you tell us a little bit about that work and that sort of underappreciated area of climate risk?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for asking. So there's been a dialogue internationally amongst central banks about and other financial market regulators about what their role in the climate challenge should be. And the U.S. so far really kind of has only tippy-toed into that a little bit. But the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and this is a shout out to in particular Commissioner Rostin Benham, commissioned a subcommittee of its Market Risk Advisory Committee to focus on climate-related market risks. And I was privileged to be part of that team, and we prepared a report that was recently released. It's on the CFTC website. And it really describes what it is that central banks and other financial market regulators ought to be doing to do their part in the climate challenge. Now, to start with, this is not a substitute for action by Congress to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to undertake other measures to ameliorate the damages of climatic disruption. That is first and foremost, I think, the job of Congress and the executive branch. So here we're talking about the independent agencies. But the first recommendation of our group was to put a price on carbon and take action such that market forces shift the economy, shift investment, shift technological development in a way that reduces emissions cost effectively. So that's the number one recommendation to the Congress and the executive branch. The rest of the recommendations focus on these other institutions, and they do have special powers. And the first is to really recognize that there are profound risks associated with both the damages from a disrupted climate, from the litigation against companies who have exposed themselves through various actions in not mitigating emissions or misleading investors. We don't know where our tort system is going to go with that, but I think these litigation risks are non-trivial. And then the risks, as I alluded to earlier, of the transition to a low carbon future. And so high emitting companies, high emitting industries, those that rely on those industries, in their supply chain are all going to be exposed potentially to some very serious shifts in the demand for their products and goods and services. And so those companies need to be preparing now. But the question is, what does this mean for the financial sector and banks and investment companies and so on? Like, what should they be doing? And I think this is where we really get into this question of trying to anticipate and prepare and mitigate systemic risk not just to one institution, but to the banking sector as a whole, perhaps in a particular region. Like, let me just give you one example to just elucidate. These fires in California have burned 4 million acres, more than that, actually, this year. This more than doubles the previous record of burned acreage in the state of California. And so what is happening? People are losing homes, but banks are saying, and insurers are saying, well, we don't want to invest in these fire-prone areas. This is getting worse every year. Why am I going to want to write a mortgage on a home in these areas or a commercial property? Why am I going to want to sell insurance to folks in these very risky areas? And, you know, okay, well, if you can't get a mortgage, then nobody can buy your house. And that's going to have profound effects on property values. And then all the banks that hold the debt associated with those properties are going to then, you know, see a retreat in the capital on their balance sheets. And so, you know, maybe California will step in and insure these people or make sure that there's some way that they can get mortgages. But this is really a very, extended chain of impacts through the economy, through the financial sector. And that's just one example of one climatic damages. Like, you know, we've got toxic algae in Florida and, you know, decimating the tourism industry there on top of all the pandemic outcomes. We've got chemical fires in Louisiana because of the Hurricane Laura dumping chlorine gas on nearby neighborhoods. Like, you name it, there's dozens of these really kind of alarming outcomes that we're already experiencing and are likely to get more of over time. And believe me, they do have profound financial market implications.
Again, I'm gonna say this again. The cost of doing nothing is not zero. So many questions coming out of that answer. Thanks, Adele. I think I might start by going to Sammy, just with a real specific question. Are we starting to see some of those financial impacts with this, with respect to real estate and insurance? Is that starting to play out in California yet?
Yeah, I think it definitely is. I mean, I haven't written about this personally, but we've done coverage at the LA Times that, yes, I mean, there are communities in the wildland urban interface, as it's referred to in, you know, in parts of Northern California and parts of the Sierra, you know, north of the Bay Area as well, where insurers are saying, yeah, we don't want to insure people in these communities anymore. And in fact, the California Insurance Commissioner has, you know, stepped in with this sort of temporary stop, telling insurers they, you know, they can't pull out of these communities, at least temporarily. But, you know, his power to do that is not unlimited. They're going to have to work out some other solution. It's a real serious problem.
Thanks. I think I might also follow up on the carbon pricing question that Adele brought up. I know that's Adele's bread and butter, and it may bring you back on that in a minute, but I think I might go with Barry in the Nate to talk a little bit about, we've seen policies on the Democratic side move a little bit away from carbon pricing, perhaps with the idea that it's not quite fast enough to get to where we need to go. And I'd like to hear your opinions on that, and also your opinions on the potential for a carbon pricing policy to foment a little bit more bipartisanship around this issue. Market-based approaches are typically more popular on the Republican side. So let's start with Barry and then go to Nate about the potential for carbon pricing in the next administration, and could it be bipartisan?
Sure. Thanks, Samantha. So two pieces here, one of which you raised, is the idea that this would be an all-made-by-Democrats piece of legislation. Or do you try to kind of reach across the aisle and build that proverbial larger coalition that Joe Biden has certainly been focused on in many respects over the course of his very long career? And there's also this big question, do you really try to establish the United States as a global leader on climate change, but take the carbon price entirely out, when that's been a linchpin of so much thinking and so many other systems around the world? Would you really try to put together an omnibus bill? There's one other piece here that I think also is important to begin to think about, and it goes back to my point earlier about constitutionality. And here I'm mindful that we're going to have to be thinking about any bill. Could it pass constitutional muster? Remember, we're 10 years into the Affordable Care Act era, and the only reason that bill survived is that Chief Justice Roberts found taxation and spending powers in a provision of that bill protecting it. Governments can tax, governments can spend, courts really don't go there. But when we get into the design of lots of regulatory standards and provisions and other things, even if they come through statute, unless they are very clearly and cleanly defined and within constitutional boundaries, your point about the acceleration aspects of this, whereas a carbon price in theory could be implemented pretty quickly, especially if it's a tax, many regulatory provisions could take a good many years and are likely to face much more of a challenge. So there's a mixture of considerations to weigh and think, but you're quite right. The carbon price sort of never disappears from our conversation, and yet it does appear increasingly on the Democratic side to have been marginalized or at least pushed over to the corner for now. And then with it, one last point, we're seeing in so many places where a carbon price is being developed around the world, not just to create that price for markets, but to think of transitional funding for all the kinds of linked and connected sorts of purposes, much as we see in the northeastern states that run the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. If we are going to have a spending-centric strategy, trillions of dollars a year, without a dedicated source, what is the political will to sustain that unless it's in some way linked to a carbon price? And I think that's an even harder question to begin to answer.
Nate, on to you.
Yeah, so, and I know Adele's going to have some thoughts about this, I suspect. So let me see if I can step carefully here. So I think, Barry, you laid it out really well in terms of sort of some of the considerations. I would say, look, you know, I'm not going to speak for anybody or any candidate here, but I think there is widespread agreement across the community that a carbon price is a very efficient and, in that sense, helpful way to deliver an all of economy U.S. climate policy. But it's theoretical, and it's very hard to sometimes align all the actors to get it done. So I think, again, we have broad agreement on the way that it works, broad agreement that it would be a good policy. The question is, not only is there a carbon price, but what is the price? Is it high enough? Because honestly, you have to talk about both of those things. And there's a lot of people that love a carbon price at $10 a ton, and it's not going to do the trick. You have to have a carbon price that's significant and rising if you want to do it right. And if you want to get to the goals that we've sort of set for ourselves in the global sort of scientifically informed conversation. So ultimately, those are critical questions. And we also know, I'm mindful of all of Barry's very important admonitions here about like how complicated and difficult it can be to do it piecemeal. But we also know that some of those piecemeal approaches can be effective. Right. We have tested them, energy efficiency standards. You know, we have state policies on portfolio standards. We have technology deployment policies. We have production and investment tax credits. I know that economically speaking, they're not perfect, but they do the trick. And so the question is, how do you cobble together a set of policies that is doable in the near term, recognizing the challenges that Barry raised? You know, like I'm not trying to say this is going to be easy, but then also delivers the goods in terms of the quantity of reductions that we know we need to do. And so ultimately, I think that I think that there's great openness. If the Republicans want to actually create some ideas around this, go for it. Let's hear it. And we'll see what happens, right? I mean, but right now there hasn't been much coming in any official capacity from the Republican side. So, you know, I think there's, you know, Let's hear the bipartisan comments from the full spectrum, and then we can maybe put some of those in the hopper and see what comes out.
Adele, I can't let a conversation on carbon pricing end without bringing you back in. Do you have any closing comments on the topic you want to bring to us?
Yeah, sure. You know, look, I understand that the progressive left is a little queasy about pricing carbon, in part because they don't necessarily trust the environmental outcomes of relying on market forces and the profit motive and all that. But I would say, look, you know, you're not going to get where you want to go with spending alone, right? Because maybe you're spending $2 trillion in federal dollars, but what about the many other trillions of dollars spent in the private economy? How are those being allocated? And don't you want to allocate those in a way that really encourages the substitution away from more emitting activities? That seems like it should be a no-brainer. Like, why would you not embrace those incentives along with your other policies? And I would just say that I do think, you know, okay, it's great to have an emissions target, whether it's for the power sector or the economy, but by itself, that's not a policy. How are you going to get there? What are the exact mechanisms? And I think carbon pricing and a carbon tax in particular have been held to a different standard because it's specific and we have legislation and we can analyze it, right? But what's your other policy? You know, and you put that on the table and we analyze it and you understand the distributional outcomes, the effect on jobs, the effect on the macro economy, on trade, whatever it is people are worried about, then you're talking, okay, now we've got two specific things that we're really comparing with each other. And then I think it's the playing field that looks very different at that point. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to ambitious targets, but if you don't say how you're going to meet them, you haven't even really begun to articulate your solution to the challenge, in my view.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I heard during the Democratic primary debates, various targets put out there, and it's like, oh, candidate X has a stronger policy than candidate Y. And it's like, it's all vaporware until you have policy behind it. But Sad, I want to turn to you for a minute on all this, because we've gotten a little wonky in a good way. That's necessary. But I want to hear a little from you about how do we bridge this gap with voters and with young people about, okay, we have all these goals and we need to meet them in order to have a planet that we'd all like to live on. But on the other hand, they're hard. How do we bridge this gap between these incredible expectations that voters are going to have should Biden get elected and the actual reality of legislation? How do we keep that group involved, engaged, positive, and helping to move the ball forward?
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't think that it's hard, is the truth. We have every bit of technological feasibility to accomplish most of these reductions in carbon emissions, right? And I think what we see is a lot of these really ambitious plans coming out there in the United States, across all those democratic platforms, and even globally in different countries. But what we consistently are missing is what Adele was just getting at, is what's specific about this that you're actually going to do and implement, right? Carbon pricing, carbon tax, it's specific. It's something that you're actually going to do. But, you know, when we have the IPCC coming out, where I'm actually an expert reviewer, saying we essentially need to reduce our emissions in half by 2030, that's a 7.5% reduction every single year. And so I think if we want people to continue to engage in this, and if we want, you know, our candidates to actually do something, what we're looking for them is, okay, so in that first year, how are you going to reach that 7.5% reduction? It's not by continuing to continue fracking. It's not by, you know, drilling the Arctic. And if you're going to do that, you're already locking in more carbon emissions. So what specifically are you actually going to do to reduce those emissions? And I think young people across the board are looking at this and just wondering, like, dude, like, what are we doing? Can we handle 4 more years of this? And the reality is we can't, because that 7.5% number, we'll go to 10, 12, you know, just increase that percentage that just becomes technologically infeasible. We can't actually move our systems that quickly from what we've seen. And so unless we start taking dramatic action, we're going to continue to see these environmental crises loom over us. And I just am just dumbfounded by how we're not seeing any sort of real policy proposals coming out of what specifically we're going to do the first 100 days to specifically address climate, what we're going to do across those 10 years. Like, it's nice to have a target for 2035 or 2050 or whatever, but what specifically are you going to do? And then looking at the other side, what I don't like about the framing of these conversations is because there is a 2035 number, there's that actual real point you can criticize, but there's nothing on the other side. So they just avoid that criticism in this conversation entirely. And we have to be clear that there is no climate policy from Donald Trump. There is nothing. We have seen literally nothing. And so, you know, we can't continue to just give a pass and lack that criticism and then go on in and in and in on Biden when, you know, he has come much more progressive, as we've already said, but there is really nothing on the other side. And I think that when we're looking at that, it's becoming more and more clear. And, you know, even looking at that last debate, very clear the difference between Joe and Donald in their climate policies.
Yeah, no, I would even argue that the Trump administration has climate policy. It's just backwards.
True.
But let's turn, I really can't have this discussion without talking about like the A number one issue of the day, apart from the election, and that's the coronavirus. I mean, we have seen this global pandemic bring disruption throughout society globally. It has been a long time since we've had any single issue that has brought the world this kind of disruption. However, when this all got started, I got a lot of questions from reporters of being like, is this a positive? Energy demand has gone down, skies are bluer, is this a good thing? And I've consistently made the argument that killing the economy is not the way to deal with climate change. But green stimulus really could be a way of both helping to solve the climate problem, creating jobs. But the question is there any appetite for this? And Lisa, I think I'll come back to you. We haven't heard from you in a bit. I would love to hear your thoughts about, is there any appetite for this under either administration? Frankly, it hasn't gotten a ton of attention from the Trump administration. It's gotten some non-specific attention from the Biden administration. What are we seeing in terms of appetite for trying to make the most of this horrible crisis?
I'd say that, you know, from our reporting, this question that you're asking ties directly into the question of how would a Biden climate plan get done? You know, we talked about how under the Obama administration, you know, some may quibble with my history here, but right, like first they had to deal with the recovery. And I know there was a big chunk of renewable energy money in the recovery package, but first they dealt with the recovery, then they dealt with healthcare. And by the time they got around to climate change, the political will to get climate over the finish line for multiple interweaving complex reasons that we won't get into here, you know, wasn't there. And so one thing, as I've talked to folks in the Biden camp and surrogates, is sort of a lessons learned about the, you know, about 2009, 2010. And, you know, you're coming into, if there is a Biden administration, what would be coming into a different but similar economic, you know, moment of incredible economic need. And, you know, I think what we're seeing is the difference in the thinking in the Biden camp is that you are not siloing out climate change into a different policy, but weaving it into economic relief from COVID and an infrastructure package. You know, the question of what appetite there will be for that, I think that goes back perhaps to Barry's, you know, delineation of, I mean, I think we have a real choose your own adventure scenario depending on what the makeup of the Senate is. If you have a Democratic Senate, you know, there is more likelihood that Republicans, you know, there will be Republicans who will come along, I think, on, you know, on an infrastructure or stimulus package that includes some of the money that, you know, that Mr. Biden has been talking about for clean energy. You know, if there is not, then you are left doing things really administratively, and you're really constrained at that point. The 2035 target, eliminating emissions from the power sector by 2035, the how of how that gets done by most accounts is a clean energy standard. Can Congress pass that? You know, I think that's the big question. I don't have a good answer, but I think, you know, if there is a Democratic Senate, there is a greater likelihood. I've heard a lot of, you know, conservatives who are in the climate space, you know, talk about, you know, bipartisan moves that they have seen that make them encouraged that there will be support. On the other hand, that support is probably contingent upon a clean energy standard that includes space for nuclear or CCS for gas, which are things that would be very, you know, would be cause of concern on the left. So, you know, in that scenario, is a Biden administration led by a president who, as Barry, you know, said, has been working across these coalitions and can bring them together? You know, that's going to be the question. Would a Senate have to go for, you know, nuclear options like budget reconciliation? Is a whole other ball of wax. But I might have lost thread of your original question, Samantha. I'm very sorry, but
that's okay. There's just so many interesting things to talk about. I want to follow up on that, and I think I'm going to go Nate and then Barry this time, trying to keep it all fair. I'm looking for potential points of bipartisanship, and perhaps COVID can bring some. You're talking, Lisa mentioned a clean energy standard. Are there places where we could get things done by using technologies like carbon capture and storage that still allow the use of fossil fuels? Could we use some COVID relief funds in order to sweeten things up a little and focus this economic growth and job creation? Are there ways where we could find some coalitions that we might not be seeing yet in order to get things done? So Nate, let's start with you. Do you have any creative thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how creative, but basically, you know, I think there are two ways to think about this, or there was two ways that I think about it. One is the broad kind of all of economy thinking that you, Samantha, you had sort of laid out, because I do think within a stimulus concept, you know, the idea that we are really faced with, right, or the challenge that we are really faced with right now is that we have four linked crises. We have a climate crisis, we have a COVID crisis, we have an economic crisis, and we have a racial justice and equity crisis, right? Those are four things that are linked together. They're not all the same things. You don't solve all of them in the same way for all four, but they also share some elements. And I think that there are ways to think about how a kind of jobs, economy, clean energy growth, and an infrastructure investment strategy, which we know we need to do anyway in a lot of cases for our infrastructure, could be something that does, you know, attract attention from not only a kind of spectrum across sort of political lines, like sort of bipartisan, but also a spectrum of different kinds of levels of government and different kinds of organizations and different sectors that could see themselves being part of that kind of an overall effort, right? So there's that kind of thinking, which I think can be constructive and it can provide a locus for different kinds of actors to actually see some benefit from kind of engaging. And then the other dimension is actually sort of splitting it out and saying, like, what are the sort of kind of more kind of narrowly focused topical areas where you could imagine getting together a smaller coalition of actors that would sort of agree that this would be a good thing. So like, you know, tax credits for HVAC installers, right? HFC disposal, consumer energy efficiency initiatives, right? I've got this list here, workforce training. Here's a good one. Sort of thinking about methane leak reduction, right? So if gas companies, right, can sort of get on board with that. And that's something that many states have gotten on board with. So there's like specific things that in and of themselves aren't big enough for like a giant stimulus, but could be part of a stimulus if you package them all together to create these kinds of areas where there's enough sort of coalition support that you could imagine building a broader consensus for doing something bigger. So I think that's kind of how I would look at it, but I'm not, you know, I suspect, as you said, Samantha, what are the creative approaches? I suspect there's a lot more creativity that can be brought to bear from people like Saad in this kind of a conversation.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of silver buckshot. But on the other hand, that's what we need. I think we've all established that there's no silver bullet. Barry, do you want to come in?
Sure, more buckshot. I want to pick up on the strand of Nate's comment and one word that he used for the first time this word came up, methane. We spend little time talking in policy circles about methane, even though it's responsible for about one quarter of the estimated warming that has already occurred. It is routinely referred to as the low-hanging fruit, whether we're talking about oil and gas sector, landfill, agriculture, livestock. And there are any number of ways to think about constructive strategies, in many cases involving short-term bursts of spending that could pay large dividends. I thought it very instructive that at least in a few states like North Dakota, they began to use some of their recovery funding for dealing with orphan well issues. When you talk about that issue or dealing with coal bed methane questions, you're potentially pumping lots of money into red states. And as much as they don't like a regulatory focus, red states are happy to take federal money, especially if it might be employing oil, gas, and coal workers. I think this also fits into some of the work that Adele has been doing on just transition and how we even think about it and pay it and deal with those transitions. I do think one other thing that's really different about this period than anything that I have seen before is the absolute terror in states that are dependent on the oil and gas sector, well beyond coal, that this could be the last period. This could be the last set of opportunities to begin to transition. And I think some overtures to those states, particularly with the money to do kind of win-win cleanup programs, are particularly quite significant. Similarly, when we begin to talk about ranching practices, and it often strikes me when I visit states like Oklahoma or North Dakota, you will see cattle alongside wind turbines, alongside pump jacks. Those are big, big targets within red states. And at least a couple of those, as I see, not the wind turbines, but the oil and gas areas and the livestock produce lots and lots of methane and some real opportunities for gains and advances. In fact, I think, Nate, the only thing I would say that I would disagree with, that this is an area where I think many states have been very, very slow to act. One, they haven't had money and they have not wanted to take on protected interests in either the ag or oil and gas sector. I think this is ready-made. And really, when we look at the other non-carbon greenhouse gases, similarly to HFCs, this is a transition that is ready to be made. A number of states are beginning to think about this. There are enormous opportunities for how we deal with refrigeration and the like. And obviously, that's an executive action that the Obama administration attempted through the Clean Air Act. It was reversed in lower court, a decision written by then Judge Kavanaugh. But it's ready made for a funding and new approach through statute. So I think the non-carbon greenhouse gases are tailor made for this.
Yeah, I'll jump in with a little plug for that. I completely agree with you, Barry. And part of that is clearly we need to tackle the carbon challenge, but because it's so central to every part of the modern economy, it's the most difficult part. And in order to get the 7.5% increases that Saad has reminded us that we need to get, and the IPCC has told us that we need to get, we have to pick the low-hanging fruit while we continue to work on the CO2. And methane emissions, I mean, even a lot of the large oil and gas companies are actually behind greater regulation of methane emissions because they understand they have a public face. They need to be somewhat responsible. They don't want to be the public face of increasing emissions of this very potent greenhouse gas. And so it's just that the methane is so, so important. I'm curious, we're getting towards the end of our time, but I kind of like to go back to a really brief discussion of subnational action. I want to kind of end on a positive note, and I feel like that the states have really been laboratories of innovation. And so there's a couple of you who are in good positions to talk about this and talk about things that might continue no matter what happens in the election. So I think I might start with Sammy and then come to Nate, who I know who's been really involved in the subnational work. Sammy, you're based in California, and they have really just led the nation in their push to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And they're a very large economy on the world stage. Are Californians on board? Do Californians feel like the policies in place are doable, obtainable, and not going to harm California's economic growth? Like, how are California's very ambitious policies playing out politically there? And is there anything we can take from that as we think about national policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that California has shown is that as you have policies that succeed and do the things that they're intended to do without, you know, creating the economic devastation that was once predicted, people really do get on board. I mean, the big example in California, we've been talking about clean energy standards. I mean, California, you know, first came out, you know, close to 20 years ago and said, we're going to do 33% renewables by a certain year. And then they said, we're going to do 50% by a certain year. And, you know, now they're saying we're going to do 100% zero carbon by 2045. But the reality is California's grid, and I think the number for last year was already something like 63% of the electric generation was carbon free already when you do, you know, solar, wind, nuclear, hydro. And pretty much everyone's on board with that policy at this point. I mean, not everyone, you hear some concerns about it, but, you know, you look at the legislature, you know, even among the Republicans, there's no serious debate about whether or not we should be pursuing that policy anymore. It's all about, you know, what are the impacts? How do you mitigate them? How do you keep costs down? There was a Republican leader of the assembly in California several years ago named Chad Mays, who recently left the Republican Party and became an independent. And I heard him talking at a hearing this week, and he said, look, when I first came into the legislature, I don't know that I would have said that I believe in climate change. And now I think it's, you know, I think it's ridiculous to talk about belief in climate change when we see so clearly that it's happening and when we have these policies that are, you know, working to address it. You know, I think when you get past things that are already done and are working, you still have these difficult debates to get through. I mean, the announcement by Governor Newsom a couple of weeks ago that he wants to set this goal of no more sales of gasoline powered vehicles in California starting 2035. That was met with a lot of, concern and frustration from some parts of the state, but it hasn't been done yet. I would certainly think, based on the experience with other policies, that, 5-7 years from now, if we do start to see a really big uptick in EV sales, and people, embracing this as the auto companies roll out these models, that probably won't seem nearly so controversial, 10 years from now as it does now. So I think that California, does show that, that you can build support for this stuff, but it takes a little time and you've got to show that it works first.
Nate, do you want to follow up on, California's been in this position for a long time. It kind of goes back to the Clean Air Act waivers that they've had. They've always been a leader on environmental policy, but are states willing and able to follow? Do states have the political gumption to be able to go some of these ways? And what can they do on their own?
Well, I think the answer is just unequivocally yes on both of those. I think Sammy kind of made a great point on this, which is that, we all know California is often out ahead, right? And so there's often a kind of tendency to be like, okay, well, that's California, that's different. Tell me about the rest of the country, right? And I think that's a fair question, but I think that the evidence is that sort of, strategy is actually then playing out, right? So if I'm going to tie back both to Sammy's and to Barry's excellent comment from a few minutes ago. So on electricity, right? So in fact, it was, as Sammy mentioned, Hawaii, it was the first 100% clean electricity, but shortly followed by California. Now 13 states, Puerto Rico and 165 cities have 100% clean electricity commitments. One third of Americans now live in a jurisdiction that will be powered by 100% clean electricity under those current commitments, right? So it starts with sort of the leaders, but then others, as Sammy I think correctly said, often the kind of once that sort of door is opened, and now we are in a world, I think Adele kind of touched on this earlier, that the market for energy is the cost. Samantha, you know this too, like the costs for different energy technologies have shifted so radically in the last 7 years, where the renewables, gas in and of itself is, an issue I'm going to leave off to the side for the moment, but the renewables costs have dropped precipitously. And that creates all these other options for states to look to do that. So we've seen this kind of expansion that's also happening across a lot of other kinds of areas that states have some control of. EVs, for example. Now there's 12 states that have committed to putting 3.3, this is my statistic from our reports, 3.3 million light duty vehicles on roads by 2024. I suspect that number, by the way, will go up. Public bus fleets, one third of US public transit fleets have committed to electrifying buses, right? So again, this is something in the city jurisdiction zone. It's not 100%. This ties back to Barry's point. It's not quite there yet from the sort of subnational, but the options are there. And Barry's point about the non-CO2s, the methane, a good point for kind of, multi-party collaboration on the methane stuff. There's now 7 states and 27 gas companies have agreed to methane gas leak reduction. And that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg with respect to methane stuff. And that, as Barry mentioned, and then HFCs, the refrigerants, 16 states have passed regulations or legislations that would phase down HFCs. Again, not 100, we're not there yet, but it's kind of what we're seeing is this kind of expansion of activity from the leaders to now the kind of middle tier kind of joining in with this. And the question is, over the next, say, 5 years, with a combination of additional state and city action, and possibly, as we talked about at the top of the hour, additional, federal re-engagement from a potentially Congress and executive branch, depending on how the elections play out, that might actually be able to kind of add in those pieces that Barry was kind of noting were missing.
Great. Thanks so much for that somewhat optimistic wrap for us. I just want to add a few words here at the end. Something that we've heard today and something that I heard some of the candidates as in the run-up to the election talk about is we're realizing now that climate is an issue for everybody. It's not an issue of saving the earth for our grandchildren who might choose to live on the coast. this is about all of us now. We are all seeing impacts. And some of our speakers today have talked about those impacts. And so it's really helpful. I mean, it's a shame that we've reached this point where we're all actually feeling the impacts of climate change. But we do need to understand that this isn't about, it's about the future, but it's also about all of us right now. And so I'll just conclude with a plug to get out there and vote. I probably don't have to convince people to who are tuned into the seminar to go out and vote, but go vote, make your voice heard. Make sure the people you know get out there and vote. That's the best way that ordinary folks have to make their views known. So I'm gonna wrap on that sort of civic duty note. I wanna say a huge thank you to all of our panelists who got an incredible amount of information out in a short amount of time. And I wanna thank all of you for tuning into this webinar, and I hope you'll join us at future Brookings events and maybe someday at Brookings in the future when we get to do that again. Thanks to everybody.